lids fluttering closed. "Anything else would be bad news for you, my friend. You know it's true."
7. Elodie. Nun Elizabeth Mary Whitlock was hanged for suspected witchcraft in the rectory of Wolf Hall's tiny Gothic church in 1794. I learned this on Wednesday while exploring the old tumble-down building with Karina after our last class of the day. We sift through piles of broken glass from the shattered windows, the shards worn smooth and opaque like colorful old sea glass, and Karina finds an ancient rosary. It's beautiful, the beads alternating between what looks like labradorite and solid silver, and on the end, a large, delicate crucifix dangles, cast in gold. We're both too scared that it might have belonged to Elizabeth Mary Whitlock to keep it, so we bury it in the crowded graveyard at the rear of the church, next to a headstone so old that the lettering carved into the stone has worn away to nothing. On Thursday, Karina guides me to a dark, cramped crawlspace at the back of a cleaning closet at the end of our hallway and urges me inside. At first, I'm petrified. I am not good with tight spaces. Over the past 3 years, I've done everything I can to master my fear, from locking myself in closets to even tighter spaces where I can hardly move at all, learning how to breathe and to overcome my roaring terror. Against all odds, I can now endure the pressing claustrophobia. But the prospect of crawling into the dark, narrow space is still a daunting one. Aside from my panic, I'm also suspicious. Karina, with her easy smile and her friendly, gregarious laughter, treats me like we've been friends our entire lives. I've never met a girl like her. An ugly part of me, the part that's been the subject of plenty of ridicule and abuse at the hands of other female students in the past, thinks she might be setting me up for some epic prank. I decide to trust my gut, though, and I climb inside, ignoring the frantic thrumming of my heart, holding my breath to keep from inhaling in the dust, and I scramble forward on my belly until I'm spat out inside a huge cavernous attic with a bank of small dirty windows overlooking the lawn and the turning circle in front of the academy. Karina whoops delighted as I explore the abandoned, cluttered attic, watching me with open glee as I scavenge through travel chests and rotten cardboard boxes, amazed by the treasures I find inside. On Friday, the girls from the fourth floor, Press, the redhead, Rashida, Chloe, Lauren, and even Damiana, all gather in Karina's room, which is at least twice the size of mine, and we all sprawl out on beanbags, pillows, and cushions, and watch Love Actually, which everyone's amused to learn I haven't seen before. We share popcorn. We talk about our respective countries, our childhoods, and our differing yet oh-so-similar upbringings. And everything feels both new and very much the same. I was thrilled when I learned that I was coming back to the States. I would have been thrilled to get sent anywhere, so long as it was away from him. Now that I'm here and I'm actually making friends, though, it feels like I could actually be happy enough here. I'm enjoying my classes, and even Damiana seems to have defrosted a little. The only potential thorns in my side are the Riot House boys, and not a one of them has even so much as looked in my direction since Tuesday. My room is as cold and drafty as a morgue, and the lights flicker every time I turn them on. My bed is lumpy and uncomfortable as fuck. But with Colonel Stillwater on the other side of the world, I haven't slept this well in, well, ever. Ren aside, I'd say as first weeks at new schools go, this one's been fairly successful. Saturday morning arrives, and my bedroom door crashes open with an ear-splitting bang. I hurl myself out of bed, heart slamming in my chest, adopting an automatic fighting stance that has Karina, dressed in a bright orange jumpsuit, arching her right eyebrow at me like I'm certifiably insane. Whoa, now, Jackie Chan, what the hell is this all about? Are you about to karate chop my neck or something? I take a calming breath, straightening out of my defense stance as quickly as possible, laughing nervously under my breath. You know, military father. He used to drill me harder than he drilled his men. This is not a lie. It's the truth, just not the whole truth. She's been amazing and welcoming, but I don't know Karina well enough to be spilling that shit just yet. Maybe I'll never know her well enough. Karina cringes, patting me on the shoulder sympathetically. I literally thank God every day that my parents are just lazy shits and not army personnel. I'm not cut out to be duck rolling from beds and preparing to fight a split second after I wake up. You amaze me. Uneasy, I tug at the oversized Real Madrid soccer jersey I slept in last night, wrangling it into position so that it covers the tops of my legs. Seems like Karina bought my half-truth, or at least she didn't suspect that it was only a half-truth. Catching sight of the old digital clock on the nightstand, I groan at the time. Oh my God, Karina, what are you trying to do to me? It's 6:45. That's what time we always get up. During the week, it's Saturday. Am I not entitled to a lie-in? A little R&R? It's cruel to wake a girl up before 8 on the weekend. Carrie laughs. If you're not up and out before 7:30 on Saturdays, Harcourt makes you help serve community breakfast in the dining hall. You get stuck cleaning pots and pans until midday. And if you're not out of the building by 8 on a Sunday, Mr. Clarence makes you attend his non-denominational gratitude service. And that, my friend, is a fate worse than death itself. Ah, damn. I guess there's still a lot to learn where the day-to-day operations at Wolf Hall are concerned. Community breakfast sounds like torture. And non-denominational gratitude service? Yeah, fuck that. How long do I have to get ready? I ask, already beelining for the closet to grab an outfit. 25 minutes, Karina advises, checking the time on her cell phone. Shower, makeup, and hair. Let's go. 1 second over and we're gonna be stuck ladling porridge onto food trays like convicts on mess hall duty. And I did not wear this jumpsuit to be ironic. Go, 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 go. For the past 5 days, my world has been Wolf Hall. The classes, the people, the building itself. It's all been so overwhelming, so much information thrown at me all at once, that my mind hasn't considered the world beyond the edge of the academy's immaculately kept lawns. Now that I'm in Karina's beaten up, yet classic Firebird, speeding down the long winding roads with the wind blowing in my hair, I suddenly feel free, like absolutely anything might be possible. New Hampshire is a breathtaking feuillement kaleidoscope. All burnt oranges, umber, russet, crimson, and carmine. The winter trees, still stubbornly grasping onto their colorful autumn foliage, whip past in a blur as Karina burns through the chicanes and hairpin corners that lead down the mountain like she was a rally driver in a past life. Soon, we arrive in the town of Mountain Lakes itself. A dozen or so quaint little shops, a high school, a football field, and not much else. And I'm pleasantly surprised to discover that the town is actually bordered by 2 beautiful, vast, and shining lakes. Karina pulls up outside a diner called Screamin' Beans and slams the parking brake on the car before the vehicles even stopped moving. I haven't driven much since I passed my driver's test in Israel, so I can hardly judge, but Karina's a little hair-raising behind the wheel. Come on, she commands. These guys have the best breakfast, but they stop serving super early so the Wolf Hall kids don't bother them. Aren't we Wolf Hall kids? I call after her as she bounds toward the diner entrance. We don't count. Come on. Karina picks out her own table, a corner booth next to a vintage jukebox, and makes herself at home. I sit opposite her, wondering exactly how many coffees she had before she kicked down my bedroom door this morning. It's unholy that anyone should have this much energy at such a horrendous hour, even if the sun is shining. Well, 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 look who it is, Miss Karina Mendoza in the flesh. Thought you'd gone and died up on that mountain, girl. Where you been? All our lemon cake went bad last weekend. We don't make it for anybody but you. The waitress who comes to serve us smiles broadly at my friend, leaning casually against the side of the booth. She slaps her notepad on top of Karina's head, studying me suspiciously out of the corner of her eye. And who, pray tell, is this? Jazzy, this is Elodie. Elodie, this is Jazzy. She's worked at Screamin' Beans for the past 25 years. 20, girl, 20 years. Don't go making me older than I already am. She pretends to sulk, stuffing her notepad back into the front pocket of her apron. I take it you don't want no lemon cake today? No coffee neither? Oh my God, Jazzy, you know 5 years wouldn't make a difference, Karina says, catching hold of her by the hand. You're gonna look 18 until the day you die. Please don't take away the coffee. Jazzy laughs, rolling her eyes. Okay, okay. I'd hate to have to see a poor, undernourished, impoverished child such as yourself having to beg for some caffeine, she says, laying it on thick. I'll be right back. You want coffee too, child? She asks me. Hot tea, please, if you've got it, and a little cold milk on the side. I don't think my out-of-the-ordinary order does me any favors in Jazzy's eyes. Straight black drip coffee she can get on board with, but hot tea with milk? She probably thinks that's a posh Wolf Hall kid type of order. She jots down my request all the same and hurries off in the direction of the kitchen. Most of the other kids drive over to Franconia in search of a Starbucks. They don't realize the coffee here is so good, Karina says. And you haven't been going around sharing your secret? Hell no, she smirks, waggling her eyebrows. This is my cloak and dagger spot. I only bring the best, most trustworthy people here. Glad to know I made the cut. She's about to hit me with a comeback, her eyes dancing and sharp. But then, the mirth radiating from her abruptly vanishes. She sees something over my shoulder, and everything about her changes. The bell above the diner door jangles, announcing a new customer, and Karina shrinks down into her seat, all of her enthusiasm vaporizing in a puff of smoke. Yeah, well, I'm usually very good at gauging who should be allowed into the Screamin' Beans Club, but sometimes even I make an error in judgment. Behind me, a male voice with a thick English accent asks for a table for three, and my insides tangle themselves into a knot at warp speed. Impressive how quickly I go from relaxed and at ease to frozen and uncomfortable. Karina and I must be quite the sight sliding down into our seats. We can get our breakfast to go, I suggest. Drive until we find somewhere nice, or we could eat by the lake. It's shitty to have to leave just because Dashiell's showed up, more likely with Pax and Ren in tow, but we're not at Wolf Hall now. I don't want the weekend ruined by their bullshit. Karina shakes her head. He's seen us. It'll look weak if we bail now. We should just chill and make the most of it. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to react that way. It's just... Dashiell knows exactly how to get under my skin. She might not want to talk about it, but my curiosity is getting the better of me. I have to ask her. I have to know. I take it something happened between you guys? Something romantic? Huh. She shakes her head, looking up at the ceiling. Romantic? Yeah, I guess you could call it that. He was charming and polite. A real gentleman. Treated me with respect. Took me out to dinner, wined and dined me. Made me feel so special that I thought I was the only girl he'd ever been interested in. And that fucking accent. He got me good, Elle. I swear, I've always prided myself on being smarter than the dumb girl who gets duped by a handsome guy with a few cheesy pickup lines. I should have seen it coming. I should have seen him coming a mile off. But he totally blindsided me. I was saving myself. Hadn't even let a guy graze my fucking kneecap with an index finger before. I was a virgin. And I'm talking virgin. No experience whatsoever. And then, lo and behold, Lord Dashiell Lovett IV comes along with his family fucking title and his airs and graces, and he looked deep into my eyes and told me that he loved me, and I just... She throws up her hands in disgust. Her knuckles bang the table, clipping the wood when she drops them. I just spread my damn legs for him like it was nothing. 2 days later, he asked me to meet him in the observatory after dinner. So I went along, excited about getting to see him, getting to kiss him, getting to tell him that I'd fallen head over heels in love with him. And I walk in to find Amelie Gibbons on her knees with his dick all the way down her throat. A tear streaks down her cheek, and my heart squeezes tightly, aching for her. Reaching across the table, I hold her hand, shaking my head. I don't even know what to say. And you know the worst part? She says, laughing shakily, batting away the rogue tears. The worst part was that he didn't even care. He wasn't embarrassed. Didn't scramble to push her off him or pull his pants up or come after me. He saw me, standing there in the doorway, saw the hurt and the pain in my eyes. And he fucking laughed. He said, she clears her throat, frowning deeply. He said, looks like I might have made a scheduling error. Can you come back in an hour? I should be ready to go again by then. Wow, what an unbelievable prick. So shitty. Who does something like that? Any guy with money, a title, an accent, and a name like fucking Dashiell? A voice in the back of my head offers. It seems so obvious after the fact, but I get it. Karina is a smart girl. But guys like Dashiell are master manipulators when they want to be. They're exceptionally talented and very well practiced at getting what they want. It can feel so real at the time. I can't count how many guys I've come across like Dashiell Lovett. The only reason I never fell for their bullshit and gave them precisely what they wanted was because my father would have murdered me 10 times over and then some. He only let me hang out with Levi because he knew he was gay. It never ceased to amaze me that my father could hate so many people to such brilliant and astonishing degrees for all kinds of stupid, pointless reasons, but he never had a problem with me having a gay friend. I wish I'd been there, I tell her. I'd have kicked his ass for you, no question. There's still time, she jokes, smiling lopsidedly through a fresh round of tears. You're a good friend. Maybe if you had been here, you might have been able to talk some sense into me and stop me from making such a fool of myself. Don't do that. You didn't make a fool of yourself, okay? You trusted someone who lied to you and broke your heart. That reflects poorly on him, not you. At some point, karma's gonna come along and render him infertile as punishment. Jesus, I really hope not. God damn it. What the hell is it with these boys sneaking up on people? I should have been paying attention to Dashiell's precise whereabouts, especially since we're talking about him, but I dropped the damn ball. Dressed like he's off to watch a polo match, the smug motherfucker leans up against the counter, popping a toothpick into his mouth as he glances from me to Karina. His gaze settles on her, full of contradicting emotions. For a second, I think he looks remorseful. But then I see the cruel delight flickering in his blue eyes, and I want to leap up out of my seat and kick the fucker right in the kneecap. "Can you kindly fuck off?" I hiss. "This is a private conversation. You're not welcome at this table." Dashiell looks to his left and then to his right, his eyebrows hiking up to his hairline. "Sorry, mon amour. I'm over here at the counter, minding my business. What fault is it of mine if you're talking loud enough to wake a dead man and give him a hard-on? I heard something about Amelie Gibbons on her knees with someone's dick in her mouth, and I lost all sense of propriety. And then," he laughs, holding up a finger, "and then I remembered that I had Amelie Gibbons on her knees, and my dick was in her mouth, and things just got really messy, because that was a really fun time, girls, a really fun time. I am sad you don't want to play with me anymore, though, Carrie. I guess I should have said I was sorry or something. Better late than never, though, right?" Holy shit. The stones on this prick. Jazzy arrives with our drinks at the worst possible moment. She hums under her breath, swaying from side to side as she sets Karina's coffee down in front of her and then arranges my tea paraphernalia for me. Her smile disappears when she sees that Karina's been crying and her cheeks are still wet. "What in God's name?" She looks at me like I'm responsible for her friend's distress. But then she sees Dashiell loitering by the counter and her expression darkens. "Oh no, 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 no. I don't know who you are or what your name is, boy, but you better be out of my sight in 2 seconds flat or you are gonna wish you had never been born." Dashiell nearly purrs. "Ma'am, I am a nihilist. I don't really care if I live or I die. Mustering up the amount of energy it would require to wish I'd never been born is very unlikely on my part. I commend the rousing speech, though. Can I get a wet cappuccino when you have a second?" Jazzy just stares at him. "Boy, you must have got knocked on the head when you was a child. You ain't getting no wet nothing. Now get the fuck out of here before I call the cops on your ass." I admire Jazzy's tenacity. She's a waitress in a small town diner, probably scraping by on minimum wage. She knows Dashiell's a Wolf Hall student. She must know that, with one call from Dashiell to his father, Screamin' Beans will have been bought out and shut down before she can even aim a kick in the spoiled bastard's pants. Still, she speaks her mind. She won't let herself be cowed by him. A brave woman indeed. Dashiell grins. It's unsettling, that grin. It makes me want to duck for cover. "You remind me of my grandmother. I didn't like her very much. She was a very outspoken woman." He runs his tongue over his teeth, shoving away from the counter. "I'll honor your request and make myself scarce. My friends might order a to-go for me, though. I'd appreciate it if you kept the saliva to a minimum. There's a love." He stalks off without acknowledging Karina again. "That smug little piece of shit. I'm betting he never had his hide tanned for him. I ought to do him a favor and put him over my knee, wallop the shit out of him on account of that smart-ass mouth of his." I wouldn't, Jazz, Karina says morosely. He'd only enjoy it. An hour later, after we've picked over our meals and emptied our coffee cups, neither of us really in the mood to hang out anymore. Karina drives me back to the academy. She stops in the middle of the road a couple of miles before the long winding driveway that leads to Wolf Hall. She sits in the middle of the road with the car engine idling, staring straight ahead out of the windscreen. Karina, what is it? She blinks as if coming back into her body. On the right, through the trees. Look hard enough and you'll see it. See what? I squint over my right shoulder, peering through the thick tree foliage. The house, she says. Riot House. That's where they live. The three of them together. Their little fortress against the world. It takes some effort and a re-angling of my head, but they're... Yes, I see the outline of the building now. A three-story affair, wood, concrete, glass. So expertly blended with the camouflage of the forest that it'd be impossible to pick out if you didn't already know it was there. If you ever find yourself stranded and alone on this road, do not go knocking on that door for help, Elodie, Karina mutters. Whatever you do, no matter the circumstances, do not step foot inside Riot House. For better or for worse, you won't come out the same. I didn't even see Ren back at the diner, but I'd felt his presence sure enough. As Karina throws the car into gear and slams her foot on the gas, I experience that same prickling sensation again. It feels as though Ren Jacoby is watching me. And Karina can speed away from Riot House as fast as she likes. I won't be able to escape that place. Or him.
8. Ren. Back at the diner, leaning against the table in our booth, I'd pressed the flat, dull blade of the butter knife into the fleshy pad of my thumb, staring at the back of her head. Wondering what the hell was going on inside her skull. I've never cared what a girl's thinking or feeling before, but I can't stop myself from trying to piece together the enigma that is Elodie Stillwater. Does she miss her old life? Her old friends? Does she miss the sun and the heat and the ocean and the sand? Would she kill to be back there in Israel with her father and the life she was accustomed to? I've become a parody of myself as I walk the old, familiar pathways to my classes at Wolf Hall, trying to maintain an exterior of practiced boredom and complete disinterest, when in truth, I am anything but disinterested. I am anything but bored. For the first time in a very, very long time, my ears are pricked, my mind's engaged, and every part of my being is turned toward a girl I do not know in the slightest. I want to know everything there is to know about her, and I want to possess that knowledge, to own it, just as I want to own her. I'm determined to make her my creature, my pet. The challenge of such an inconceivable task makes my dick harder than fucking tungsten. All right, settle down. Eyes on me, friends. I need to know each and every one of you is listening. That includes you, Jacoby. Come on, shades off. Why the hell are you wearing shades indoors anyway? Fitz is wearing his corduroy blazer today. Baby shit green. He only wears that blazer when he's been reading Byron or Rilke and fancies himself one of the romantics. Poor bastard. He hasn't been tortured enough in this life to make a good poet. With exaggerated care, I slide my wayfarers down the bridge of my nose, eyes drilling into him as he dumps his record bag down at his feet. I don't have to explain myself to him. I'm sure as hell not going to tell him that I wore sunglasses to this English class so I could watch a certain delicately beautiful student sitting on the other side of the room undisturbed. You know me, Fitz, I rumble. You always have my undivided attention. He pulls a face. Yeah, right. No comeback. He mustn't have had a coffee yet. Even as I'm thinking this, our illustrious leader flips back the front of his record bag and pulls out a thermos, popping the little white cap from the top of it and unscrewing the seal, flooding the room with the bitter, fragrant smell of Arabica. It's that time of year again, guys. Storm season. We've had a number of new students since the start of last winter, so this information's important. Even if you were a student here last winter, I'd still appreciate a few seconds of your time to go over this. Think of it as a refresher. On the other side of the room, sitting on a yellow worn sofa beneath a cliché and utterly classless print of Gustav Klimt's The Kiss, Karina nudges Elodie with her elbow and whispers something into her ear. In my mind, it's me leaning into her, bringing my nose to her hair, close enough to catch the scent of her and store it to memory. I've imagined what the silken, smooth texture of her skin looks like up close, too. I've pored over her image on electronic screens and studied it, committed in ink, but I haven't held her down and inspected her features in person yet. I want to. More than anything. I want her underneath me, straining against me, as I figure out the way she frowns. I want to see what her fear looks like. Most importantly, I want to see the lie on her. The one all girls try to tell, when their panic catalyzes with their desire, and they try to comprehend their own traitorous nature. In case you haven't bothered to check the weather report over the past 24 hours, the entire state's about to face down a major storm front, Fitz says. These storms can get pretty hairy. Lightning strikes, flash flooding. Luckily for us, we're on the top of a mountain, so we aren't in any danger of getting washed away. Wolf Hall's basically bomb-proof. It was built to withstand crazy weather. The wind can get pretty treacherous up here, though. Once the storm hits, there will be strict rules in place. No venturing off academy grounds. No leaving the building in general. If things start to look really sketchy, there have been occasions when Principal Harcourt deems it fit to move everyone into the basement, just in case. In the unlikely event that we need to evacuate the site, every student needs to be aware of the protocols set in place. Fitz rambles on about the buses that will come to take us down the mountain if a state of emergency is declared. He goes over the emergency exit points, first aid points, blah, blah, fucking blah. I turn off, bored to my back fucking teeth. I've heard it all 1,000 times before. Elodie hasn't, though. She's transfixed, hanging on Fitz's every word, taking mental notes in case disaster comes looking for us here at Wolf Hall. A strange, unfamiliar part of me wants to reassure her and let her know that there's nothing to worry about. The rest of me, the part I'm intimately acquainted with, relishes the sight of her, all timorous and concerned. I like her clothes. Her "smile if you're dead inside" t-shirt's just as cliche as the Klimt painting, but it tells me something about the way she sees herself. Her distressed jeans are so tight they look like they've been painted onto her thighs. My palms ache with the idea of what her skin, muscle, and bone might feel like through the worn soft denim. The scruffy Chuck Taylors look so lived in that I can tell she's put hundreds of miles on them. I prefer the Doc Martens she usually wears, but I enjoy the way the Chucks make her feet look small and petite. My little Elodie has the feet of a fucking geisha. That said, these warnings sound scary, but there really is nothing to worry about. This will be my 10th year teaching at Wolf Hall. A few fallen trees are the worst I've seen. Go about your day as normal. Do your work, make sure you follow the rules, and everything will be business as usual. Fitz's statement doesn't make Elodie feel better. Our eyes lock from across the room, and the panic in her gaze makes my pulse soar. She frowns, creases forming across her forehead, and I realize that I'm staring without the convenience of my Ray-Bans to disguise my interest. Look away, Jacoby. Look away. I should, but I don't. I'm trapped by the pressure of her eyes on me. A slow, cunning smile begs to be unleashed across my face, and I relent, giving it free rein. Elodie jumps, startled, like I just dumped a bucket of ice-cold water over her head. She looks away first, and the satisfaction that courses slow like tar through my veins feels like victory. Miss Stillwater, are you okay? There's no need to look so worried, Fitz says. I promise, it's gonna be fine. If you're worried about anything, come and find me. I'm nearly always here in my room. Aside from sharing the brilliance of Lord Byron with you. Oh, Fitz, I can read you like a fucking book. It's also my job to keep you guys safe. Damiana shoves her hand in the air. Can all of us rely on you to be our knight in shining armor, Dr. Fitzpatrick? Or does your heroic valor only extend as far as Elodie? Fitz's disgusted look is dirtier than the sock Pax uses to jerk off into. I'm here for all of my students, Dami. You're well aware of that, no need for ugliness. Damiana snorts. I couldn't be ugly if I tried, Doc. And you're the one showing favoritism to the new girl because she's got that doe-eyed innocent thing down and she's rocking a great pair of tits. I'd say that was ugly if you asked me. I didn't. No one did. Thank you as always, though, for your valuable input, Damiana. If anyone feels unsafe over the next 48 hours, please know that my door is open to everyone and anyone, regardless of their... Dashiell won't look at a girl unless she's got double D's. Pax, God knows what the fuck Pax likes. He's never demonstrated any sort of pattern where the women that he selects are concerned. He's far more interested in their personalities. That sounds like bullshit, but it's true. There are certain flaws and weaknesses Pax looks for in a girl, usually heavily revolving around their daddy issues. Me? I like my girls to have smaller breasts. Anything more than a handful is a waste. I didn't need Dami's shady comment to draw attention to Elodie's chest. I've spent plenty of time thinking about it before, but since she's brought the matter up, I treat myself to a cursory glance at Elodie's tits. Her shirt is two sizes too big, swamping her frame, but there's a suggestion of breasts there. And the suggestion of breasts is always far more exciting to me than, say, Damiana's obvious in-your-face cleavage. That shit's grotesque. Fitz rambles on, talking about safety and using common sense. I spend a lazy 30 seconds picturing how pretty Elodie's lips would look, parted and wet, if I slipped my hand up underneath that tent of a t-shirt, yanked down the cup of her bra, and viciously rolled her nipple between my fingers. When I snap out of my deviant reverie, Kylie Sharp is reading aloud from a bound book, but no one's paying attention. Damiana snaps her gum. Dashiell's eyes are fixed on Karina. Pax is openly asleep, head lolling on his shoulders, his arms folded across his chest, legs crossed at the ankles. Fitz's gaze is on his shoes and... Whoa. Hold the fuck up. Covertly, Fitz looks up, glancing at Elodie out of the corner of his eye. I wait for him to look away, but he lingers on her. Just that little bit too long. The muscle in his jaw ticks. That's when he finally looks away. What the fuck was that, Fitz? I do not fucking think so, homie. As if my thoughts were piped directly into his mind, Fitz's head snaps up, his eyes meeting mine, where they waver for a beat. He knows exactly what I've seen, and the motherfucker doesn't seem to be worried. He knows me, so he should also know that I don't take well to other guys eyeing my property. Possession, regardless of the fact that the other party is unaware they're someone else's property, is 9/10 of the law, and I've always been willing to defend what's mine. Fitz has the audacity to smile at me. Smile. That piece of fucking shit. Overhead, a deep, threatening rumble of thunder growls over the top of Kylie's dark words. I had a dream, which was not all a dream. The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless, and the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. The thunder crashes again, a portent of what's to come, an ill omen, sending an anticipatory shiver racing down my spine. When I turn away from the delusional English teacher, Elodie Stillwater is staring at me. Over the next 30 minutes, I catch her watching me again and again, peering at me from under dark eyelashes. And every time it happens, my resolve strengthens. There's a connection here. A bizarre, uncomfortable link that makes me sweat every time I think about severing it. I wonder if she feels panicked and distressed and turned on whenever she hears my voice. She's the first out of the door when the bell goes. She ducks her head, throws her bag over her shoulder, clutching a turquoise file to her chest, and she whirls out of the room before Karina's even on her feet. I haven't been paying attention to Karina. I haven't even spared her a sidelong glance. She is Dashiell's self-imposed punishment, not mine. It looks like her skin is crawling, and she's about to throw up as she navigates a pathway through Fitz's worn, haphazard furniture, slowly crossing the room toward me. Fucking wonderful. I know what's coming next. Karina, Karina, sweet little Carrie, the mother hen of the fourth floor. Fuck knows when Harcourt designated her protector over all new female students, but she must take her role very seriously if she's willing to come here and face me down. She clears her throat, announcing her presence. I'm looking down at my cell, feigning ignorance, but of course I know perfectly well that she's there. Karina?
You could have the decency to put the phone down for a second.
Her voice is colder than the glacial tone my ex-stepmother used to affect whenever she addressed my father. Smiling wickedly, I give her what she wants. I raise my head, looking her right in the eye. It's been my experience that plenty of people want to get my attention. When they have it, they very quickly want to give it back. Karina's no exception. She flinches under the weight of my gaze. She's stronger than most, though. She doesn't look away.
I've got one word for you, Jacoby. Don't.
Oh, this is going to be entertaining. Don't be so devastatingly handsome. Don't be smarter than every single man in this place. Don't make my heart flutter in my chest every time you look at me. Karina clenches her jaw, nostrils flaring.
You're many things, Ren, but slick isn't one of them. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I've seen you looking at her. Just don't.
She spins on the balls of her feet and hurries toward the exit, making her escape before I can toy with her some more. Carrie never was any fun. I have no idea what Dashiell sees in her. That looked like a cutting exchange. The classroom's empty now, bar myself and Fitz. Dashiell and Pax might be my boys, but neither one of them can stand Fitz. They have their reasons. They won't linger in his classroom a second longer than is required to maintain their grades. Casting a menacing scowl in the teacher's direction, I get to my feet. I'm pretty pissed at you, old man. Fitz leans against the writing desk next to him, resting his hip against the wood. With his arms folded across his chest and a wry smirk on his face, he looks like he's the one who's pissed at me.
We've been through this, he says, letting out a weighty sigh. You've made your intentions perfectly clear. I've told you I think it's a bad idea. After what happened with Mara, I grab his face with one hand, digging my fingers into his cheeks.
The stubble on his chin bites into my hand, bringing back memories I'd rather forget.
I'd appreciate it if you didn't bring her up again, you know? The situation's nothing like what happened with Mara. You, more than anyone, should know that. Right? My blood turns to ice as Fitz's eyes roll back into his skull. He looks like he's caught in that confounding middle ground between fury and ecstasy. Right. Yeah. You're right. Elodie's mine. I've already cleared it with the boys, and I don't need to clear shit with you. You won't go near her. Nodding, Fitz reaches up and takes hold of me by the wrist, slowly pulling my hand away from his face. I won't go near her. He swallows hard. I leave his room just as the first bout of rain begins to lash at the windows.
Nine, Elodie. 972-3556-3409. I can't believe you're gone. Everyone at Mary's is devastated. We're all in shock. We'll never forget you, Elle. You'll always be missed. I love you. Levi. I smile down at the WhatsApp message from my friend, relieved that he's finally reached out. Dad replaced my phone with a device from a U.S. cell provider when he packed me off to the airport, and I lost all of my numbers. And annoyingly, Levi is one of those, technology is evil and I will have no part in social media, guys. So I've had to wait for him to make the first move. The tone of his message is super weird, though. Me. Wow. No need to go making out like I died, dude. It's not like I moved to Mars. We can figure out a way to hang in the holidays if your mom doesn't whisk you off to Switzerland or something. How's everything going? Has Professor Marshall checked himself into rehab yet? Our old science tutor was forever nipping into the back of his room to sneak a hit from his hip flask. There were rumors he was using the chemicals on hand in his lab to concoct his own. My phone buzzes. Its loud ringtone echoing off the walls as I climb the endless stairs up toward my room. I cringe, silencing it, checking to see if there are any members of faculty in sight. Phones are prohibited in common areas. Luckily, I'm already on the second floor, and the only people in close proximity to me are other students. Hey, dude, I wasn't expecting you to call right away. I'm almost back at my room. Give me a second to... Elodie? There's something about Levi's tone that stops me in my tracks. He sounds... I'm not sure what he sounds like. Something isn't right, though. Lee, what's up? Is everything okay? What's happened?
You're alive,
he whispers. I've been friends with Levi for 2 years now. Not a long time in most people's books, but we've crammed a lot into those 730-odd days. I know him inside and out, and he knows me too. Every dark, dumb, stupid, embarrassing little secret I've ever had. From Sweden, he's fairly representative of his people. Stoic, serious, ever calm, and deeply grounded. He doesn't really let anything affect him. He keeps his emotions close to his chest. Those words, though. His voice was choked with tears when he said them. My friend is fucking crying. What are you talking about? I'm alive? Of course I'm alive. I'm in New Hampshire. Levi sniffs, making a strangled sound.
I'm sorry. I just need a...
He stops talking, draws in a deep breath. He sounds like he's trying to compose himself. And then he says,
Your father told the dean you were in an accident, Elodie. The entire school's been in mourning all week.
I've reached the fourth floor landing now. Thankfully, I've left the stairs behind, or I'd probably fall face first down them. I slap my hands out against the wall, steadying myself as my vision dims around the edges.
Sorry, what did you say?
Levi coughs. I can picture him in his bedroom back at Mary Magdalene's, in his pajamas, perched on the edge of his bed, his wonderfully brown eyes vacant as he tries to process this news. I'm alive. I'm speaking to him on the phone, back from the fucking dead.
The whole thing is too confusing to comprehend. I'm really struggling here, Lee. Sounds like you are too. Can you explain what you meant when you said my father told the dean I was dead, though? 'Cause my brain's melting out of my ears right now. He came to the school on Monday, showed up with a full military guard. We thought there was some sort of threat to the school at first. Then Ayala saw him with the dean. She said he talked to him for a second in the hall. That Dean Rogers looked shocked and tried to put his hand on Colonel Stillwater's shoulder, but he backed away, spoke for another brief second, and then marched off, got back into his car, and disappeared. Next thing we know, we're being pulled into our homerooms, and we are being told that you were in a plane crash over the weekend. They said you didn't make it. What? What the fuck is he talking about? Why the hell would my father tell such a vicious, flagrant lie? It makes no sense. He didn't do that. He couldn't. I mean, I can totally imagine him doing it. On his nicest day, he's a vile monster who doesn't give a flying fuck about anyone else but himself and his own precious career. Why would he have said that, though? He could have told the staff at Mary Magdalene's I was being relocated. It happens all the time. Students coming and going from these kinds of schools. I'm sorry. I know this is crazy. I'm fine, though, Lee. Really, I promise, I'm totally fine. Never been better, in fact. I know you probably have 1,000 questions, but I have to go. I need to call my father and find out what the fuck is going on before I have a nervous breakdown. Okay, Lee says, laughing shakily. All good. Call me back, though, yeah? If you don't, I'm gonna think I dreamed this up and you're still dead. Don't worry, I'm 100% gonna call you back. You have my word. I hang up, reeling from the brief conversation. Over the years, my father's done a shitload of cold, hurtful things to me. He's done the most heinous things imaginable. He's never told people that I'm fucking dead, though. Dead. What the fuck is wrong with him? I'm numb all over and dizzy as I hit the call button on the only number my new phone came equipped with when Colonel Stillwater gave it to me, the number to his personal aid. The phone rings 8 times, 9 times, 10. I think it's about to go to voicemail when Officer Emmanuel finally picks up. Colonel Stillwater's office, how can I assist you? Carl, it's Elodie. Carl's only been with my father for 6 months, but that's 3 months longer than any of his other military aides have lasted. Usually, the lucky ones are reassigned pretty quickly. The guys who had no strings to pull or favors to call in had to somehow make it through month after month of my father's explosive, borderline abusive behavior before he finally lost his temper with them and had them demoted to cleaning out latrines. Elodie, great to hear from you. How are things stateside? Are you enjoying being back home? I like Carl, and I think Carl likes me. He was always appropriately apologetic whenever he had to pass on a hostile message from my father. It kind of felt like we were co-conspirators who empathized with one another, because we each knew what the other person had to deal with on a daily basis. I just got off the phone with one of my friends from Mary Magdalene's, Carl. Oh, man. The chipper pitch in his voice takes a nosedive. Well, I can imagine you're pretty pissed right now, he says. I'm confused right now. I have a sneaking suspicion that I'll be angry soon, though. A group of girls pass me in the hallway, concerned looks on their faces. I realize what I must look like, hugging the wall, white as a sheet, tension pinching my features into a pained expression. I give them a tight smile to let them know everything's fine, even though it's not. Why the hell did he do that, Carl? Why did my friend just call me in tears, devastated because he thought I was dead? I don't think you're gonna like the explanation, Spit it out, Carl.
Your father had me look into your old school's tuition rules. It turned out that the only way to get a partial refund for the semester you were already halfway through was if you were... was if you had died. So... oh my God. Un-fucking-believable. So he told them I'd died in order to get a partial refund for the remainder of the semester? What does that come to? $4,000? Carl gives up the exact amount reluctantly. Not quite. 2,800. He has millions in the bank. Millions! I know. He let my friends believe I'd died for the sake of $2,000 and change? I did try and explain to him how it might make you feel. I suggested we tell you what was happening so you could let your friends know you were okay, but he... but he didn't give a shit about hurting me or hurting my friends, and he told you to keep your mouth shut, right? Something like that. Jesus Christ. Sorry, Elodie. I should have sent you a heads up. With elastic, wobbly legs, I walk down the hall toward the door to room 416. I need to get into my room and sit down before I fall down. It's okay. It's not your fault. None of this is your fault. My father shouldn't be such an unbelievable bastard. Carl titters nervously. He wasn't the one to call my father an unbelievable bastard, but these lines are generally recorded. If the top brass finds out he was even present to hear trash talk against my father, he could wind up in some serious shit. Want me to let him know you called? I could try and persuade him to reach out and explain his actions for himself. I'm at my door. I twist the handle, pushing it open. God, no. No, that really won't be necessary. I already know the details. What good would talking to him? I grind to a halt, halfway through the door, my ears suddenly filled with a high-pitched ringing. Do? The room. Holy fuck, my room has been destroyed. My clothes are everywhere. My books, the few I brought with me from Tel Aviv, are scattered all over the floor, pages torn out of them in clumps, strewn all over the hardwood floorboards. Every single drawer has been ripped out of every single piece of furniture, the contents upended and thrown around in disarray. My photographs are in shreds. My laptop lays on its side beneath the window, its screen shattered and flickering, a spasm of color interrupting the static every few seconds. And there are feathers, feathers everywhere. They've settled in a thick layer over everything, like powdery, delicate snow, covering the Persian rug and my shoes and the comforter that's been ripped from the bed. Both of my pillows are in shreds. With my mouth hanging open, I walk toward the bed, too many thoughts bumping into one another for any of this to make sense. The sheets have been ripped back from the mattress, and the mattress itself... a giant Bowie knife protrudes from the center of the pillow top mattress, its rugged carved handle glinting threateningly as I duck down to get a better look at it. Whoever did this didn't just stab the bed once. Numerous 3-inch-long rents in the material, as well as longer jagged tears where the foam and the springs inside the mattress have been exposed. Perhaps handled in a more empathetic way. I can't really say any more than that, of course, but... shit. Carl's still talking on the other end of the phone. Sorry, Carl. Something... I've got to go. I've got to go into class now. Thanks for explaining things to me. I'd be really grateful if you didn't tell my dad I called. Of course. Anything for you, Missy. Thanks. I kill the call, dropping the cell phone to the ground. What the fuck happened in here? Who would do this? And why? Oh.
Holy shit! Karina's standing in the doorway. She gapes at the chaos in horror, her eyes roving over my broken and ruined possessions. I see the china bird my mother gave me on my 10th birthday, smashed into tiny fragments and ground into the low pile of the rug, and a pained cry slips out of my mouth. What the fuck happened in here? Karina whispers, stepping over an empty drawer. She comes and wraps her arms around me. It's here, stiff as a block of wood and unable to breathe properly, that I realize there are fierce, hot tears streaking down my cheeks.
I don't know.
It comes out as a moan, a cry, a desolate and mournful sound that shocks the hell out of me. It's not my clothes or my books or the bed that's done it. It's the bird, my mother's bird. She's dead and she's gone, and there will never be another gift from her. The bird was all I had, and now it's gone too. Fuck! Come on, come with me. Karina guides me out of my room and down the hall, past Presley and some of the other girls who came to watch the movie with us on Friday. I make an effort to avoid making eye contact with any of them. I can't face their open pity. I don't want to even acknowledge that this is happening right now. Karina leaves me in her room and tells me to keep the door closed. She disappears for a long time, and I do nothing but stare into space, thinking about the bird. The pink nail polish on Mom's fingernails when she gave it to me. The little chip on its tiny orange beak that I used to rub my fingertip over whenever I cradled it to my chest. The white of his chest that faded to the blue of his back, that deepened to the dark midnight blue at the tips of his wings. The song Mom used to sing when she would hold it high in the air, pretending he was in flight and swooping around my head. An eternity passes. Principal Harcourt comes to see me, tells me they've already gotten another mattress out of storage for me. Very lucky, actually. It's brand new, still in the plastic. And they've tidied up most of the mess. She informs me that it's safe to go back to my room now, which feels laughable and absolutely stupid because, of course, it's not fucking safe. Someone knifed my bed to death. But I follow after her, my legs mechanically doing their job as I re-enter room 416. Karina hugs me, an anxious smile on her face. My clothes have all been folded and returned to their rightful places in the closet and the chest of drawers. The furniture is reassembled and back where it belongs. The bed's been made up, sheets on the mattress to disguise its newness, and there are two fresh pillows plumped up like fluffy sheep, leaning against the headboard. Everything appears normal, if a little emptier now.
There was no point keeping the books, Karina says softly. We wrote down the titles, though. Principal Harcourt says she's going to get replacements for you.
My eyes sweep over the surface of the furniture, searching. And the little china bird?
I'm afraid Gustav vacuumed up some of the pieces before he realized there was something on the rug,
Principal Harcourt says from the doorway. Her voice is clipped and harsh, and she clearly doesn't want to be dealing with this anymore. She has better things to be doing at 8 p.m. on a dark and stormy night, and none of them include pacifying a troubled teen about a broken ornament.
If you know where it came from, we'll happily get you another bird as well, Elodie. We'll have a new laptop for you soon, hopefully. Just make a list of anything you need, and we'll make sure it's taken care of.
She turns around and walks off down the hall, her heels clipping angrily against the hardwood as she goes, leaving me and Karina alone in my bedroom, which now smells of chemicals and plastic and brand new mattresses.